Thank Bianca, Valentin, for the kind invitation to come here to the PI. I'm really delighted to be here. So I will be talking about the combinatorics and the thermodynamic limit for black holes in loop quantum gravity. And most of the things that they will be talking about here have been done in collaboration with these guys there, Ivan Agulló, Jacobo Díaz-Polo, Enrique Fernández Borja, and Eduardo Villaseñor. So this is the plan of the talk. There are three main things that I will be talking about. The first one is some details about how you do the countings necessary to compute the entropy for the different proposals that exist these days in loop quantum gravity. Then I will describe some features of the entropy and how they can be understood by using the kind of methods that I will be describing in the first part of the talk, these combinatorial number theoretical methods. And then I will say something about the thermodynamic limit for black holes, and in particular using as a model this description in loop quantum gravity. Now, my goals are threefold. There are three things. The first is describe in some detail the mathematical methods that you have to use to compute the entropy in this setting. Second, argue that loop quantum gravity black hole models really describe the entropy very well, and there are many interesting things that you can see there. And third, show that one has to be careful with the thermodynamic limit, in particular if you are interested in looking at not only at the leading behavior of the entropy as a function of the area, which is the Bekenstein-Hawking law, but also if you want to understand subdominant corrections to the behavior of the entropy. The reason is that this subdominant, all the models, all the successful models for black hole entropy give you the Bekenstein Hawking law. That is the way to check that what you are doing makes sense. But then different proposals differ with regard to the subdominant correction. So it is interesting to discuss how these subdominant corrections appear, and in particular, what happens in the thermodynamic limit with the subdominant corrections. That is, those are the three main points of my talk. Now, I will not tell you anything about the description of black holes in loop quantum gravity, but just start because otherwise I will not have time to say what I want to say. And I will start just by stating the kind of combinatorial problems that you need to solve to compute the entropy. I will show you two different combinatorial problems that correspond to two different proposals. This is what you have to do if you want to compute the entropy in the so-called Lomagalla-Lewandowski proposal. And as you can see, it's a very concrete combinatorial problem. You have, in order to compute the entropy of a horizon of some area according to the rules of quantum geometry and the Ashtekar, Bias, Corici, Krasnov framework, you have to do the following thing. You have to compute the logarithm of a certain number, Na, that is defined as follows. It is 1 plus the number of all the finite sequences, Mm to Mn, of non-zero half integers, such that two conditions are satisfied. The first condition is that the sum of these numbers is 0, and the second condition is this inequality here, which involves the square roots of absolute values of these numbers and the area, okay? I will be working in units for which 4 pi gamma LP squared is equal to 1, okay? Gamma is the Mitze parameter and LP is the Planck length. So this is one of these combinatorial problems. Another one, which corresponds to a more recent proposal by Engel, Nui, Perez, is the following similar thing. You have to compute again the logarithm of some number, and this number is obtained as follows. It's 1 plus the number of all finite arbitrarily long sequences of non-zero positive half integers that satisfy two things. An inequality of very much like the previous one. I mean, if you just change gi by the absolute value of mi, it is the same. And then the multiplicity, there's a multiplicity that you have to take into account, which is given by the dimension of this invariant subspace. So there is some part in the prescription which is essentially the same as in the previous for both approaches, And then there are some details which are different. Is this here you have to compute the dimension of this invariance of space and take that into account as a multiplicity. And in the other case, you had to impose this condition that the sum of the m's is zero. I may refer to that condition of the sums of the m's equal to zero as a projection constraint. Okay? So these are the kind of problems that you have to solve. Yeah. There are some others. Sure, sure. There are some.
One of the main ones which is the area is just j, not square root of j, j plus 1.
Yeah, and actually we also have worked with that proposal. It's only just and the methods are similar. So it's, I want to compare at least two proposals to show what things are the same and what things are different. But of course there are several others, and in fact we have done computations with the others. Okay, if you're interested, I can give you the references. So this is the only thing that I will say is that these numbers that appear in the previous prescriptions are labels associated with some speed networks that pierce the horizon, the isolated horizon that models a black hole in this setting. So this is a picture of the kind of thing that we are looking at. Okay. So these numbers don't come out of the blue. They come from a prescription that takes into account a quantization in the presence of some inner boundaries that are not anything, must be isolated horizons. And it is precisely the labels of the spin network that pierce the horizon that appear in these counting problems. Okay, I will not insist on that, but just to give you some idea of where these numbers come from. Now, how do you solve these problems? I will give... Instead of giving you the details, I will use generating functions, okay? So instead of giving you the details of the computations that give the generating functions for black holes, which are relatively easy, but it's a little bit messy, what I will do is just tell you what these generating functions are from a pedagogical point of view, and then I will show you what the generating functions for black hole are and how they work, okay? So generating functions are used in many branches of mathematics, in particular in combinatorics, and they're very efficient to encode relevant information about combinatorial problems. And everything can be extracted if you have a good generating function, okay? They are used, for example, in statistical mechanics, too, in quantum field theory, in different frames. Now, let me show you a sample problem to tell you how these generating functions work. And actually, this is not an artificial problem in this setting, because part of the things that you have to do to get the black hole generating functions that I will be discussing in a moment is solving this kind of Diophantine equations. Okay, so let's look at this one, this very simple one, 2x1 plus 3x2 equal to q. What you want to know is how many solutions with x1 and x2 positive integers do you have for each value, for each positive integer value of q, okay? You want to find out how many you have for each of these q's, okay? Now, how do you solve this problem? Well, there is a very neat way of doing it, which is the following. You write down two formal power series. One is a formal power series where you have powers of x squared. So I have 1, I have x squared, x to the 4, x to the 6, and so on. And then I have another, and this 2, the red 2, corresponds to that coefficient. And now the other, the second function, is the same, but it's powers of x cubed, okay? You have 1, x cubed, x2, x6, and so on and so forth. And then I take these formal power series, and I just multiply them and look at the coefficients. Now, when you do the multiplications, then you see, if you think about it, then you see that this is what happens. There are, for example, some terms, like x squared in the product, appears once because I am multiplying x to x squared times x times 1, okay? So I get x squared in that way. Now, if I look, for example, there is no x, so that means that there is no way to get a solution for q equal to 1 by multiplying positive integers 1 for, times 2 and 1 times 3. It's quite obvious. And then what you see is, for example, when you get to 6, to the 6th power, you get a 2 in front of it, because there are two ways of writing 6 as a product of some integer times 2 plus some other integer times 3, which is this one and this one. And then the thing goes on and on. So it's clear that what you have to do in order to know how many solutions you have to assert for a certain value of q is just taking this product of formal power series and looking for the coefficient of the qth power, okay? So that coefficient, for example, these two or the one there, tells you the number of solutions to the Diophantine equation corresponding to the value of q. Now, of course, this is very formal, but in many occasions, this formal power series actually converges, or at least for some, in some disk in the complex plane. And when that happens, then it's really very useful, because then you can write down closed formulas for these coefficients instead of having to just look at them in the product, okay? So in this case, this is the first power series obviously correspond to this function. The second obviously correspond to the other function. So the solution to the problem is the following. If I want to know how many solutions I have for a certain value of q, I have to find the coefficient of the qth power of this function as when I expand it around x equal to 0. This, for example, can be written as by using the Cauchy theorem, can be written as a contour integral of this type, where the contour is a small circumference going counterclockwise and surrounding just the origin. Okay, and now the nice thing about this is that by using standard tricks in contour integration, just for example by moving this, by expanding this contour and picking and looking at the residues in these points, you can actually, you can do whatever you want. You can actually get a closed formula for this in terms of Q, or if you are only interested in the asymptotic behavior of the number of solutions as a function of Q, you can also get it. For example, if you just want to get the asymptotic behavior, the leading behavior in terms of Q, what you have to look at is at the residue in this pole, the pole with the largest real part, okay? Now here, this is a double pole, so you compute the residue, you get something like this. So you see that if you're interested in the number of solutions for large Q, basically it's 1/6 of Q, okay? But again, if I take into account the other residues, I can actually get a closed formula. So it's relatively simple. I mean, it's not too complicated, but it is not easy to guess at first sight. You get something like that, okay? So this shows how once you have generating functions, then you really have a lot of control on the solutions of this kind of combinatorial problems. Okay. Now the question is, well, is it possible to encode the solution of these combinatorial problems that you need to solve in order to compute the black hole entropy in some generating functions? Because if you can do that, then you can, for example, try to study their asymptotic behavior as a function of the area in that case, which is something that you need to do if you want to check that you get the Bekenstein-Hawking law. And if you need to understand subdominant corrections, you can also do that. I will show you how. And if there are features in the entropy that you want to explain, if you have a generating function, then all information is there in a way that actually is very helpful in order to extract the information that you need, okay? So that is the question. Obviously, the answer is yes, otherwise I will not be talking about this. I will give you just a very, very quick idea of how these generating functions are obtained, how these combinatorial problems are obtained. Basically, there are four steps that you have to follow. The first step is the following. Suppose that you take the first problem, the Domagala-Lewandowski proposal, then the first thing that you have to do is finding the values of these guys and the multiplicity for a given value of the area. If you remember, there were two conditions that they had to satisfy. One, equality, in the Domagala-Lewandowski case, this sum of m equal to zero. And then there was an inequality where the area appeared. I had to be sure that I needed to count only those configurations such that the sum of the square root of m times m plus 1 is less or smaller or equal than a divided by some constant, by the area divided by some constant. Now, to begin with, it's simpler to consider the equality, counting the number of states corresponding to an exact value of the area, and then at the end, if you want to work with a fixed value of the area, you have to just add the result for all the values which are smaller or equal than the one that you are considering, okay? So that will be the fourth step. So to begin with, we just look at the solution of the problem with an equal sign there, Okay. Now, once you find the possible values of M that correspond to that, then you have to take into account that they can be reordered. Yes.
Or less than the inequality rather than the equality.
Well, if you look at the original papers, they, what they are saying is that they are working with a kind of microcanonical ensemble. So, and the justification is just the standard one in a statistical mechanics. If you want to work with a microcanonical ensemble in the statistical mechanics, you could, in principle, just count the degeneracy of each eigenvalue of the energy in that case. Okay, but in practical terms, it is much easier to count the number below all the states below a certain number of value of the energy, because when you go to the thermodynamic limit, you get the same result. Okay, so this is done for this reason, and this appeared in the original papers by Astekar, by Skorici and Krasnov, where they tell you how to compute the entropy. So
it just seems in this case it's easier to just do the equality since you're doing the. Rather than doing the equality.
Yeah, that is, well, it is true. In that case, it is true. But in any case, because the original prescription is that, people have been working with that prescription with the inequality, we wanted to check some results that show up there. We needed to understand how to work with inequality. And there are some other reasons. You will see it along the way, because there is an interest, the way you take into account all this area below a certain value is relatively interesting from a mathematical point of view. So the. Okay, but you are absolutely right. And for example, if you work with the kind of area operators that Laurent was saying, there you can, then there is actually the most natural thing to do is work with the equality. This is in this paper that I mentioned. Okay.
Does this affect the logarithmic corrections, the difference between equality and inequality?
That's an interesting question. There may be a difference between both of them. They can possibly be there. Actually, we can check. So that's a good question. Okay, good comment. Thank you. So the second thing that you have to do is, well, first you find what possible numbers you can have. Then, because these are order sequences, you have to take into account that they can be reordered. So there is a number that you have to compute just to take into account that. And then, once you have found the possible values satisfying this equality, you have to take into account that there is an extra condition. This thing that I call the projection constraint, or the condition referring to the dimension of the invariant subspace. You have to, there will be configurations that you find here that don't satisfy that condition. So you have to remove those, and you have to know exactly how many are left, okay? And then at the end, as I said, you have to adapt if you want to work with inequality instead of working with equality. So these are the four steps. And of course, they're not really very difficult things to do, but you have to be careful, okay? So it's not impossible, but you have to. So these are the generating functions. They look quite horrible. So there are functions, say, with a whole bunch of variables. You see that there is a variable that I call z. And then there is a sequence of variables, x1 until xn, an infinite sequence of variables, okay? And the formulas are like these, okay? Now, let me tell you how to read these formulas, how you get them, what these numbers mean, and how to use them, okay? So, well, first of all, these variables that I call xi are associated with people call square-free integers. A square-free integer is an integer such that when you write the prime factor decomposition, all the factors appear to the first power. Okay. So, for example, every prime is, of course, square-free. 6 is square-free because it's 2 times 3, so there are no powers of 2 or 3. Okay. 4 is not because it's 2 squared. 12 is not because it's 2 squared times 3. Okay. So these are not prime numbers, but they're square free, okay? So for each square free number, there is a variable associated to it, xi, okay? Now, there are other numbers here. I told you that the variables are the z's and the x, but then you see that there are something that I call k's and something that I call y's. So these numbers, these pairs of numbers, k, y, where alpha is a natural number, are solutions to a certain Diophantine equation, which is called the Pell equation, which is associated, there are Pell equations associated to each square free number, and look like this. So you have to find integer numbers such that k plus 1 squared minus the square free number that you are working with times y squared gives you 1, okay? Now, this equation is a famous equation. It was solved by Indian mathematicians in the 8th or 9th century. Actually, the name Pell equation was given by Euler, but the Pell himself didn't have anything to do with the equation or the solution. It's one of these cases of wrong attribution, okay? Now, how does this work? Well, in the same way as in the, this sample problem that I
discussed. So this question, if you give pi, there are many k's and y, or does it mean?
Okay, so the solutions are the following. If you give me some square free integer, say 6. So I have k plus 1 squared minus 6 squared equal to 1. Now, the solutions of this, there is a sequence of solutions of these, which there are pairs of numbers, k and y. There is the so-called fundamental solution, which is the one who corresponds to the smaller value of k. And then there is an algorithm to get that by using continued fractions. And then there is a formula that once you know this fundamental solution, gives you the rest of the solution. So the problem is completely solved. It is very interesting in that when you look at the, for example, you look at tables, there are the people have tabulated the solutions for the fundamental solutions, for example, in terms of these square free numbers. And when you look at the fundamental solutions, they behave in a very random and unpredictable way. For example, for some numbers, the fundamental solution is quite small. You see very small numbers, but then suddenly it jumps and you have a huge thing. So it's really nice from a purely number theoretical point of view. It's not trivial. I mean, it's quite nice. Okay, so how do these generating functions work? Well, they work very much as the one that I showed you before. Now, if I what I have to look is at the coefficients of the power series expansions of these guys, and I have to look at the coefficient in particular of the zero power of z, okay, and then x1 to q1 times xi to qi, where these q's here corresponds to the eigenvalues of the area. So you just stop for a moment. When you look at the eigenvalues of the area operator and look quantum gravity, you see that they are sums of square roots of an integer times an integer, or half integer times a half an integer plus 1, okay? So you can see very easily that such sum can always be written as a sum, as a linear combination of integer numbers times square roots of square free numbers. Basically, you have the square root of some integer, you factorize it, you take out whatever you can, and whatever is left inside is precisely a square free number, okay? One of these things. So the eigenvalues of the area spectrum, generically, all of them have this form. And the way this works is the following. If you want to count the number of configurations that you have for a certain value of the area, what you have to do is you write the eigenvalue of the area like this, pick these numbers, put them here, and look for the coefficient of this term in the power series expansion of this or this, depending on the model that you're working with, okay? So these numbers with these generating functions take into account, in both cases, this extra condition, the projection constraint or the condition on the invariant half space, okay? Now, it is true that there is an infinite number of variables, but once you see how this works, it's obvious that for a given value of the area, you only need a finite number of variables and of terms, okay?
So in the prescription that Laurent was talking about, where the operator is just j instead of square root of j plus 1, can you still do it in terms of square free integers?
No, in that case, it's simpler, because you don't have to take care of this square root. So the combinatorial problem is in a sense, simpler. So that is different. Okay. The reason why you have these guys here is precisely because you have the square roots of some things, and then you have to keep a piece which is irreducible. I mean, you cannot. If you work with this flux operator, where you just have the absolute value, then then it's different. Okay, the combinatorial problem is very similar, but you don't need to solve, for example, this kind of quadratic equation. Okay, this only appears because of the square root. Okay, okay, thank you. So let me show you one concrete example. So for example, suppose that you want to count to solve these combinatorial problems with the equality for a specific value of the eigenvalue of the area. Say that one, okay? Now, how you do it? Well, you take a generating function, that you go to the previous formula, you realize that you only have to keep terms, you only need two, you only have two square free numbers, two and three, so you only need two variables, and of course, you only need a finite number of terms. It's very easy to see that it is enough to stop here. So you have this polynomial, the inverse of this polynomial, and you go use your favorite computer algebra program. You ask for the coefficient of this term, 0 power of z, the 40th power of x1, the 40th power of x2, and you get this number. And that is the solution of the combinatorial problem. With Mathematica, this takes a second. So it's quite efficient, and it is exact. It's a huge number. I mean, you have to you cannot conceivably count this number just by generating all the configurations, but by using the generating function, it's quite straightforward. Okay, so as I have told you, these generating functions really contain all the information about the counting that you have to do. So let's plot. I mean, see what happens if you plot this number. So you work with the equality and you plot the number of configurations that you get by doing this counting, you see this funny structure. You see a structure where you have peaks with a width that looks remarkably constant, okay? So this is what you see there. Actually, if you just take into account the inequality when you sum, then you get something like this. This is for the entropy, okay? So you see, and this is for the smallest black hole. So this is in units of 4 pi gamma LP squared, okay? Then you see two things already at this point. First, you see that when you look at the entropy, it grows approximately, it grows linearly, okay? So you get this kind of, you have an average linear behavior. But then superimposed on top of that, you see these steps here. That you must understand that already at this region, the eigenvalues of the area operator are very, very close to each other. So there are small jumps that you see. There is a substructure of a small jumps here, and then there are these other steps. You see very, very many small jumps there and there and there. But then on top of that, you see these regular steps which appear when you look at the entropy. Okay, this was discovered by doing some brute force computations by these people, Corici, Diaz-Polo, and Fernandez Borja. They just wrote a program where they generated randomly these sequences, and they checked if they satisfied the conditions or not, and then they would keep them. And by doing that, for the very, very small black holes, they saw this structure. Okay, and actually, the reason why we started looking at this was because they wanted to understand if there was some underlying mathematical reason why these steps would be there. Okay. So let me just stop a little bit to discuss how you take into account the sum that I discussed, that I was referring to take into account the inequality in the definition. Now, the way to do that is by using Laplace transforms. And this is, at the end of the day, this is interesting because Laplace transforms appear when you go from the microcanonical to the canonical ensemble. So at the end, when I will be saying something about the thermodynamic limit, this will play some role. Now, if you have worked with generating functions at some point, there is a trick which is very neat that you can use if, for example, you have to solve the following problems. Suppose that they give you a sequence, okay, a number sequence, and they give you a generating function. So you have a function such that the coefficients of the power series expansion around zero are just the elements of the sequence, okay? And now someone comes and tells you, look, I want you to sum the sequence. So I want you, if my sequence is something like, is AI with I a natural number, I want to know what this thing is. I want to be able to compute the partial sums, let me call them like that, and see if I can get a generating function for that, okay, for the partial sums. But if you have a generating function for that, suppose that you have f of x equal to the sum, something like this, power series, you have a function with this power series where these coefficients are just the sequence that you have in there, there is a neat way to write the generating function for these other guys, which is very simple. You just divide the function by 1 minus x, okay? You do that. It's a nice exercise to see that this, what this does is precisely giving you these numbers, okay? Now, for a long time, we thought that that was a way to compute, to do the sum that we needed to do for the area, but there is a problem. The problem is that even though you know the eigenvalues, you know the closed form of the eigenvalues of the area spectrum, it's very difficult to write them as a sequence, as an order sequence, okay? To find just the formula that tells you what is the first, what is the second, what is the third. It's a nightmare. We never managed to do that, okay? So we were stuck for a long time until we realized that there was a completely different approach to that problem that really was very effective, which is using Laplace transform. Now, the idea is very simple. Suppose that you have a staircase function, like the ones that I showed you for the entropy, and you know exactly where the jumps are and how tall they are, okay? So if you have such a function, that function can always be written as some linear combination of step functions where you put here the jump and you put here the position of the jump, okay? Now, if you compute the Laplace transform of such a function, then you get something like this. You get the sum of exponentials where you have the coefficients of the exponentials are just the size of the jumps. And then whatever you have in the exponent, you have a variable, of course, because that appears in the Laplace transform, and then you have the positions of the steps. Now, this is very useful because if you really manage to get this function here for by some procedure, then, so if you get this, or you get a closed form function of this, then an inverse Laplace transform would give you this sum here, would describe exactly this staircase function, okay? Now, the funny thing about this, all this business with the generating functions is that it is actually possible to find this function by playing with the generating functions. And you have to do something which is remarkably simple. You take the generating function in terms of all these variables. Now, you substitute the xi's by this thing here, e to minus s, the square root of the square free number that corresponds to the variable, okay? You have also, for some technical reasons that I will not discuss, you have also to do this with the z variable, the x variable that appear. And once you do that, look what happens. For example, if I have a coefficient of this type in the generating function, this turns into this object here. But here you see that what you have in the exponent is precisely an eigenvalue of the area operator, the kind of integer linear combination of the square roots of the square free numbers, okay? So actually this thing is the exponential of minus ax, okay? So by doing this substitution, I get a function of s that can be expanded like that, and hence I can write the entropy, this complicated staircase function, just as the inverse Laplace transform of that. Okay, so let me show you how these formulas look like.
Can you recall what omega mean and z was counting before?
Omega and z.
The psi was the number of
ki,
but z was.
So z is introduced if you want to take into account the projection constraint or the condition on the invariant subspace. So because you need that variable to take into account that extra conditions, okay?
Okay, so integral over z is projection.
Yeah, basically. So the reason why I have, and then for in practice, it is useful to work with a mixed Laplace transform and Fourier transform for the z variable. It's just a change of variable if you want, because you want to get the zero coefficient, you need to get the Laurent polynomial and then, in practice, if you want to get the coefficients of the zero term, it is more convenient to work with a Fourier transform. I mean, there is nothing mysterious about that. But I need that extra variable to take into account that extra condition, okay? So at the end, I get these closed form expressions for the entropy in both cases that are there is a typical inverse Laplace transform, which is a contour integration along a contour which goes parallel to the imaginary axis. And then there is this extra integration in omega to take into account the projection constraint. And as you can see, well, the integrand is not horribly complicated. I mean, it's 1 over some series where you have these guys there or these guys there. So it's not completely trivial. And actually, the analytic structure of these integrands is quite complicated and quite interesting. But you have something which is tangible. I mean, you have a closed form expression. Okay. In fact, you can get the asymptotic behavior, for example, of these things as a function of the area by basically doing what I described for you when I was looking at the asymptotic behavior of the number of solutions to the Diophantine equation example that I showed you. Okay? And in fact, it is relatively easy to see that you will get that the entropy actually grows linearly with the area. Okay? Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this thing, then the coefficient that you get in there depends on the Mirzi parameter. Okay? So you want to recover the Bekenstein-Hawking law, you have to adjust the Mirzi parameter to a concrete value that will give you a 1 over 4 here. Okay? And then...
Sorry, but this adjustment is not the same for...
No, it's not the same here or here. Yeah. Okay?
And for the other one.
Exactly. In every different prescription, there is a slightly different value. But you can, but you get it in exactly the same way, okay? So this is the living behavior. Of course, you can look at subdominant corrections, and you can get them from this expression. For example, in the Domagala-Lewandowski case, you get the minus 1/2 of the logarithm. It's important to remember the minus and the 1/2. Whereas in the other case, you get a minus 3/2, okay? So you get logarithmic corrections, which are independent of the Mirzi parameter, with a coefficient, which is a simple number, with a negative number, okay? It means that if you plot the asymptotic behavior of this thing as a function of the area, it's convex like this, okay? It has a growing second derivative, okay? That will be important at some point, okay?
Can so, I ask a question? You computed the Laplace transform of the density of states, and this is finite, right?
Yes.
So does this mean that the capacity is positive?
You have to, okay. If you believe this asymptotic behavior, then you will have a then you have an entropy which is not convex as it should be. It's concave. So you have a negative heat. In that case, you have a negative heat capacity. Okay. So the sign of the heat capacity has to do with the sign of the second derivative. Okay. You have something which goes like that, which is convex. Then you have a positive heat capacity. That is what happens with the standard thermodynamical systems. You have this behavior, the one that appears in here, then the heat capacity would be negative. Okay, that is why this issue of the thermodynamic limit that I want to discuss in the end is relevant. Because when you go to the thermodynamic limit, what you see is that the sign of these logarithmic corrections change. And then the heat capacity is positive. Okay, but if you take this result at face value, then you would have negative heat capacities. You must also take into account that you are working in the area ensemble. So you're working with the area, not the energy. Okay, but the answer would be that. So let me very quickly say something about how these asymptotic expansions are obtained. So for example, suppose that you take this integral here. I have dropped one of the integrations, the Fourier to Laplace transform. Now, in detail, the way this works is the following. You have, let me just show you an example. Suppose that instead of this, which is complicated, I had a simple example like this, the inverse Laplace transform of 1 over s times s minus 1. This you can compute by hand, so this is the result. And then you get the asymptotic behavior just by doing the following. You look at the poles of the integrand, and then you get basically the residues in the pole of the largest real part tells you the leading asymptotic behavior. It will give you the exponential term. If you take into account all the residues, then you can get subdominant corrections. So this is the method by which you get the asymptotic expansion for such integrals. But I have to do it for something which is more complicated. It's not even this. It's with another integration. Now, that tells you that you have to really look at the analytic structure of the integrand that you have in there in order to understand what happens. So when you look at the, for example, at this example, then you see that the analytic structure is highly non-trivial. There are several things that are interesting. First of all, you have an infinite number of poles. Okay? Now, they are not scattered in a complex plane, but they are confined in a band which is such that the real part of these poles have is bounded by this number here. Okay? But you have to compute. I mean, there is a closed expression, but I mean, this is just the only real solution of this equation. Okay? So you have to solve it numerically, but you can get it with as much precision as you want. Now, there is a single pole which has a real part equal to this value. So all the rest of the poles have a real part which is strictly smaller than that. But something funny happens. The funny thing that happens is that the real parts of the poles have an accumulation point precisely for this value. So it's not that the poles accumulate. It's that the poles can get arbitrarily close to the line in the complex plane that corresponds to a real part equal to that. Okay, so that is telling you two things. It is telling you that the exponential growth, that when you take the logarithm will give you the linear behavior of the entropy of the area, is controlled by the real pole. Okay, but then it's this is enough to show that you have the Bekes-Hawking law. But now this funny thing of the accumulation of the real parts may have some influence in the sense that, for example, it may be the reason why this staircase structure that appears when you plot the entropy is there, okay? Because that would be some kind of change that is that would not be there if this accumulation of the real part was not happening. So for a long time, we believe that this staircase structure would be present asymptotically for large areas, and we thought that the reason was precisely this phenomenon of the accumulation of the real parts. Just to give you a flavor of how complicated this thing is, suppose that I just plot the absolute value of this guy, of the integrand, in this line, in a line which is parallel to the real axis and has real part equal to gamma n, which starts from the real pole. Now, if you plot that, you get this funny kind of thing, which is it has some regularity on one hand. You see that the peaks are are more or less equally spaced, but then you see that there is an unpredictable kind of random modulation on top of that, that it is really difficult to understand. And this is, this is because of the analytic form of the integral, okay? And now these peaks never disappear. The fact that these things accumulate means that that you will always find poles which are arbitrarily close to this line. Okay, so when you do this plot, you will get something like that. So it's quite nice and quite interesting from the mathematical point of view. And as I said, for some time we believed that this would explain the persistence of these steps. Okay. So now there are two questions that one can ask oneself. The first is, well, what happened? So is it really true that this staircase structure is present for large areas or not? And then the second is, well, does it matter if it is there? So let me just answer quickly both of them. So to answer the first, we will try to get some idea. We'll try to locate in a precise way where these jumps happen in the entropy, and also try to understand how, if the steps, the width of the steps remains constant or it widens. Okay, and then for the second, I will look at the issue of the thermodynamic limit. We'll see why. So you want to study the persistence of the steps. There is a neat way to solve the problem, which is the following. When you have the generating function, as I said at the beginning, you have all this information about the combinatorial problem. Actually, by using those generating functions and modifying them slightly, you can actually select the configurations that contribute to a single step. So you can really partition the space of configurations, or the black holes, into sets that correspond to each of the individual steps. Okay? You do that by using by taking the generating functions, introducing an extra variable, and use a number that is a counter for the steps. I cannot go into the details of that, but it can be done in quite a neat way. Okay. Now, these steps, suppose that you just take one of the configurations that I showed and you pick one of these steps. Okay. Now, you can interpret those as some non-normalized probability distribution. Okay, they are not normalized because they don't have a constant height, but of course you just divide by the height, you have a normalized probability distribution. Now, you have such a probability distribution, there are some numbers that you can compute. The first thing that a statistician will compute, which is the mean and the variance, okay? And the standard way of doing that computation is by using generating functions. Now, we have these generating functions. We can really obtain the generating functions for each of these steps, and then you can just compute the mean and the variance with those, okay? And then what happens is that the mean would give you precisely, would give you a definition of the position of the step, and the variance will give you the width of the step. And that can be done analytically in closed form. You get very complicated formulas, but you can get an analytic expression of that, and you can see how well the Gaussian probability distribution can really fit the steps. And this is one example. So this is one of the steps that is here, located at this value of the area, and then this is a plot of the actual value of the actual step, and this is what you get when you compute the mean and the variance from the generating functions and plot it. You see that it fits very nicely. And this is not a feat in the sense that it is not that we are doing some least square approximation. No, no. We take the actual exact distribution for the step and then compute the mean and the variance. Okay. So once you have that, if you add the approximation for each step, then you have a smooth out approximation for the entropy, something like this. So you see that it fits very nicely. And then what happens is that technically, it is relatively straightforward to study the asymptotic behavior to see what happens with this smooth approximation by using also Laplace transforms. I cannot go into the details of that. And then what you see is the following. It is true that each step is located at values of the area which are proportional to a constant value. So you can actually show, you can prove that these steps are equally spaced, okay? When you look at the mean and you look at the position of the mean. If you look at the pith, say the 100th step, then the jump happens at 69.918. For value of the area in the units that we're using here. But then you see another thing, which is that the width of the steps grows linearly also with the number, with the position of the step. The coefficient is very small, okay, but it grows linearly. That means that, well, if you look at the if you look at the entropy for very small values of the area, then you will see distinctively each of the steps. But once you go to values of P of, say, of the order of 10,000, things like that, then the width of the steps is larger than the separation of the position of the steps. So they fade out. And you can actually see that quite well. So this means that despite what we thought for a long time, this staircase structure will not be present for large values of the area. Okay. So that is the answer to the first question.
Sorry, so if you take the other spectra, I guess you'll have even, do you not have the second feature or not?
The fact that you have this, when you look at this plot, this kind of a spectrum that I showed, the reason that those things are equal space is actually what would explain this result here, okay?
Yeah.
The fact that this thing is growing, that the width is growing linearly, is not that obvious to see from there. But it is true that at least the fact that there are these periodic steps is related to this structure that you see in the plot that I showed. Yes.
But I'm saying if you take another spectra for the area, like the J, the modulus, then which one of these two results survive?
If you take the other spectra for the area, then you have a staircase. It's a stack. Also, the problem is completely different because the eigenvalues of the area are equally spaced.
Yeah.
So it's not that you have this, that the density of eigenvalues of the area gets larger and larger. I mean, they are equally spaced. So there you see that the values, I mean, basically they are they jump at the same place. So it's,
and they are what, one? So
no, but then okay.
The first is one and the second
then
is
it doesn't.
Zero.
Then it doesn't make much sense to do this kind of analysis because there's nothing to explain.
Yeah.
I mean,
no,
you can,
I'm just saying, what are the numerical values?
I don't remember at this point, but those are also.
I mean, the second one is zero, you're saying there's no drift. It's always the same size, and the first one is.
The second, and the first one, I don't remember, but it's in the paper, so I will give you a reference. Okay? So this is the answer to the first question. Now let's try to answer the second. Okay. Would it have matter? Would it have make sense to have this structure for large areas? And then the answer is no. And the reason is the following. Now, suppose that you look at that you take a text in a statistical mechanics, okay, and you start with a microcanonical ensemble. So what they will tell you is the following. If you want to do a statistical mechanics with a system, with a quantum system, the recipe to work in the microcanonical ensemble is the following. You, for each value of the energy, you have to count the number of states with an energy which is smaller or equal than that. It can be equal, but then they tell you that, look, it's better, it's easier if you just count for a fixed value of the energy the number of states with energy which is smaller or equal than that. By doing that, you get a function of the energy, which is called the microcanonical entropy is really the entropy of the system. And then in principle, once you have the entropy, you can start doing thermodynamics. The entropy will depend on the energy. And then parametrically, it may depend on some other quantities, for example, the volume. Then once you have the entropy as a function of the volume, the way to start doing thermodynamics is computing the temperature as the inverse temperature is the partial derivative of the entropy as a function of the energy at constant volume. Volume and you continue from there. Okay, now you think so. It's clear that there is some hand waving there because when you look at actually, if you plot this microcanonical entropy, it is precisely the kind of a staircase function that I was describing before. The entropy jumps at the eigenvalues of the energy and then it remains constant between eigenvalue and eigenvalue. So if I take that and I want to do thermodynamics, if I differentiate that, then I get something funny because whenever I can differentiate, I got zero, and then there are some places where I cannot. So strictly speaking, from a mathematical point of view, that is useless. I cannot do anything because it gives me something which is not what you would need to do a standard thermodynamics. Okay.
Sorry. I mean, what you're saying is right, but it seems to me you're making an hypothesis because. Which is that you think that the energy is a continuous spectrum. So imagine that now you compute the energy of the black hole via the mean, let's say like, you know, the Virginio is doing, and you find that in fact it's kind of, you know, it has a spectra with the same kind of step, so that the relationship between the area and the energy is a fixed relationship with no.
Well, right here I'm just talking about standard statistical mechanics to motivate what I will do later, okay? So,
but I'm saying here, the energy of the system, you need to define, so it's not clear that the energy doesn't have this step behavior. So that when you're saying that the derivative vanish, you're assuming that the energy is something that grows linearly while this guy has steps. It could be that the energy has steps so that the relationship is perfectly smooth.
Well,
you see?
Yes, but here I'm just I'm starting from something else. Standard statistical mechanics. I am not talking about black holes here. This is just standard statistical mechanics.
Yeah,
I will make contact with black holes at some point later. Okay.
Yeah, but here you're saying it's this discontinuous function of the energy. No,
you take an ensemble of harmonic oscillators. The energy of a quantum harmonic oscillator is quantized. So if you count the number of states, then then it will be jumping at the precisely the eigenvalues of the energy.
I have a comment on this on statistical mechanics, for instance, harmonic oscillators. I agree that the density of states jumps in a discontinuous way, so that its logarithm, I cannot take the derivative.
Yeah.
But still, in a thermodynamic process, what is changing it's not really the energy in the sense of which eigenvalue I have. What I'm varying is the density matrix of the system and the expectation value of the energy on this density matrix. And this one can't change continuously. So if you take a process and you just, what you vary is the density matrix, then you can compute the variation of the entropy with respect to this density matrix and the variation of the energy with respect to this density matrix and get the first law of thermodynamics. With everything continuous, because what is continuous is the variation in the density matrix.
Probably yes, but again, I'm sticking to the basic formalism of a statistical mechanics. So, so you can make contact with the density matrix at some point, but the way you start doing a statistical mechanics, I mean, you go to the Patria, you go to the standard text, or it's the microcanonical ensemble is counting, is computing the counting entropy just as a function of the energy, of the eigenvalues of the energy.
And then, of course, classical statistical mechanics.
No, quantum statistical mechanics, actually, because actually, if you have a continuous, then it's actually more complicated. Conceptually, it's more complicated in the classical case. But you just go, I mean, you go to Patria, for example. Chapter one, they will start saying, well, let's do this counting. I mean, that is how Boltzmann introduced the microcanonical entropy, okay? Then, of course, it's true that when you have density matrices, at some point you can make contact, okay? So that definitely I agree with you. But I'm just going to the simplest, most standard thing, okay? Just to justify how, just to give you some justification to go to the thermodynamic limit. So that is an argument that you can make. Okay, if you go to the canonical ensemble, then you have the opposite problem. When you sum, I mean, it's a sum of exponentials, and then what happens is the partition function will be analytic, and then if you want to, for example, study phase transition, then you cannot, because then they depend on having things that are not analytic, that some derivatives, that there are some discontinuities somewhere, okay? So, for example, there is a very nice paper by Griffiths, which is one of the people that Griffiths, Fisher, that in the 60s really studied the mathematical aspects of the statistical mechanics, where what they say is, look, the way to solve these problems is going to the thermodynamic limit. And they define the thermodynamic limit of a limit where something goes, some extensive parameter goes to infinity, but some intensive things are kept constant. And then what they show there is that the proof theorems, actually, there are theorems that tell you that, well, when you go to the thermodynamic limit for sensible thermodynamical systems, then you get, for example, an entropy, which is differentiable almost everywhere, and it is concave. It has a second... whenever the second derivative is defined, is negative. So, and they also prove that the result that you get in the thermodynamic limit from the microcanonical ensemble or the canonical ensemble are the same. Okay, so there are some. So this is just to justify that. Well, I mean, there are some good reasons to go to the thermodynamic limit, which is not just the idea of neglecting the microscopic information because they have. I'm working with a very large system, but there are some other more technical and probably deeper mathematical reasons to do that, okay? Now, what these people also show is that when you look at the entropy, then, of course, in the thermodynamic limit, all the different ensembles give you the same, but if you just study asymptotically what happens with the energy, then you see that the dominant behavior is the same, but subdominant corrections differ. And that is the reason why we are looking at this, because so dominant corrections, these logarithmic corrections, it's crucial to see what they are, to compare the different models, and also to discuss the issue of stability. If you have a correction with a minus logarithm, like the ones that they showed before, then you would have a negative heat capacity, okay? And this is, of course, very important for black holes. So, very quickly, because I am running out of time, it is possible to study the thermodynamic limit easily by using the generating functions that we found before, technically, because the way to pass from the canonical to the microcanonical is precisely by doing a Laplace transform. Exactly the same trick that we were using to do our countings. So from our generating functions, we can actually get the partition function for an ensemble of black holes, which mimics the Einstein crystal. So you have copies, non-interacting copies of the same system, which is what you had in the Einstein crystal. And then in that case, you can prove very easily that the canonical, the partition function for the ensemble can be obtained from the partition function for one object, and those we have, because we have these expressions that we got from the generating functions. So let me just show you what the how the partition functions look like. So this is the partition functions in terms of the variable conjugate to the area. It will not, because we are working with the area, it's not the temperature, but the variable conjugate to the area. And once you have these generating functions, you can actually compute the entropy and see how it behaves as a function of the area. Okay? So let me just show you how what you get. You get the following thing. So there are three plots here. The fine blue line is a numerical computation of the entropy as a function of the area. You see that it grows linearly when you go to larger area. Okay? Now, this dashed line is the asymptotic behavior, which is linear in the area, plus the first correction. And you see the first correction is logarithmic, but it has a plus 1/2 coefficient for the Magala-Lewandowski case. So when you go to the thermodynamic limit, you don't get, you get exactly the opposite correction. You get one that would give you a concave function.
Can you explain that? Why do you get plus or minus?
Why? Okay, that is really hidden in the details on how. Okay, you go back.
The Laplace transform.
You have the expression. So this is the partition function. Now the way this works is that you have to compute the average value of the area as a function of alpha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then from that you can also compute the entropy by doing the Legendre transform. It's in the previous transparency. So basically, what you do is, well, you compute the entropy per particle, say, as a Legendre transform, taking the logarithm of the partition function as a function of alpha, the conjugate variable, and also the area that you get in the standard way. This is the average value of the area. Now, this is parameterized by alpha. This is the entropy. And then, of course, the value of the area is also parameterized by alpha. Then in practice, what you do is, well, if you want to plot it, you just plot it as a parametric curve. For each value of alpha, you get a point, area, mm-hmm. and entropy. Okay, and then you can actually, looking at the singularities of the integrals that I showed before, understanding how they diverge as a function of alpha, you can actually get the asymptotic behavior. This is also in one of our papers. It's relatively messy, but it is straightforward. There's nothing mysterious there. So you see how this thing diverges. You see how the area behaves, and then you can really know get the asymptotic expansion and get the exact coefficients. Okay, so it's just the way to study the asymptotic behavior of that. Okay, this was actually something similar to this was suggested very old papers by Kirill Krasnov in the mid 90s. Okay, the only thing is that he didn't have he was working with different partition functions, but those ideas are already there. Okay, I don't want to forget to mention. So, as I was saying, this is what you get. As you can see, the asymptotic approximation really fits the exact value perfectly, okay? And then the red dashed line is just the Bekenstein-Hawking law. So you see that you see the kind of behavior that you expect, and then you get the logarithmic corrections with an opposite sign. And then for the Engel-Nui-Perez case, it's even better in some sense. So here I'm plotting just two things, the exact value, and then I'm plotting the asymptotic behavior. Now, in the asymptotic behavior, you have something which grows linearly with the area plus a constant. It's a logarithm of a number, but this is really a constant. So you don't have any corrections at first order. So there would be powers or logarithms or something like that it is harder to extract. But there are no logarithmic terms there. You get something that grows basically as some very small constant times something proportional to the area. Okay, so again, the subdominant corrections in the thermodynamic limit are different from the ones that you get just by looking at the counting entropy and looking at the asymptotic behavior of the counting entropy. So let me finish here. So there are several things. So these combinatorial problems that tell you how to compute the entropy, loop quantum gravity, can be solved with a lot of detail, and you have a lot of control of how this thing works. Okay, it is possible to recover the Bekenstein-Hawking law and also study the subdominant corrections. We have shown that this funny staircase structure that my collaborators found is not there for large areas. And then I want to emphasize the fact that one has to take into account some type of thermodynamic limit if one wants to study subdominant corrections, because subdominant corrections change in the thermodynamic limit. So one has to keep that thing in mind. If you are using a counting entropy to it may be that the subdominant corrections are different from the ones that you get when you go to the thermodynamic limit. And that is important because the funny thing is that if you look at the entropy as a function of the area, it's linear plus corrections. So it's in the borderline between being concave and convex. So if you believe that the area ensemble is the one that you have to use to study the thermodynamics of black holes, then you must be worried about what happens with these subdominant corrections, because that will tell you the thing is stable or not. And the point is that once you worry about that, you have to be careful with the thermodynamic limit. And I will end here, okay?
Wonderful question. Any other question? A question about the thermodynamics of this system. You have studied the thermodynamic limit, and now you can compute the temperature at a given energy. And
well, I can compute the alpha. Strictly speaking, I would say that I can compute the value of the variable conjugate to the area, which is not the temperature, right? I'm working in this area ensemble. Here, I only have the areas. Okay. So when I work with a canonical ensemble, it's an area canonical ensemble, and then I have a conjugate variable to the area, which is not the temperature. The temperature is conjugate to the energy. So.
Would you like to identify this area with M squared?
I have no way of answering this question within this setting. Okay.
The reason for my question is that this is clearly a statistical mechanics system that has some thermodynamics.
Excellent.
And one can ask what is the temperature associated to this system, and then ask if I should compare this temperature to something small, like the Hawking temperature at infinity, at infinity, or with a Planck scale temperature near the horizon.
I don't know the answer. I mean, you are the expert in these things. So I need to know some relationship between the area and the energy. And that you can try to get from first principles, or you can postulate it. And I don't know the answer to that. So it may be that it is precisely the kind of arguments that you're doing, or the things that Alejandro Perez is doing, just to say, look, I mean, the area and the energy are related. There is a functional relation between them, which is this. Then I have an interpretation for the energy. And then if I stick to that interpretation, then I can compute the temperature and complete the thing. But that is completely outside. I actually must confess that I have not thought much about that. Okay, mm-hmm. This is outside this setting. Here I'm doing just standard statistical mechanics with an area ensemble, which is actually what the people writing the original papers on black hole entropy, loop quantum gravity were saying. I mean, this is there right from the beginning. So the justification of that, you know much more than I do about that. And it may be something like what you're doing.
Well, since you mentioned, I mean, in the work by Alessandro and the same thing with Eugenio, it seems that, you know, in order to understand the entropy, you need an extra number, not only the area, but then the number n, which is the number of punctures. So that, you know, that's the big difference with Perez, that there is a chemical potential. This number can vary. So maybe your techniques could be extended to.
But look, I mean, of course, I agree with that. And that's a very nice idea. That's a completely different physical picture, because then you're seeing the black hole as a gas of punctures. So your punctures are really the molecules of this gas, okay? Mm-hmm. So that is the picture that you have in there. And of course, once you have that picture, then you can, for example, use the grand canonical ensemble, try to see what happens there. So you can use N as a variable. Mm-hmm. But here, the remarkable thing is that We just start with the combinatorial problems that I showed at the beginning. Okay, so I'm counting some numbers of sequences. I don't care much about the interpretation of the labels, if they are associated to punctures or not. And I'm counting number of arbitrarily long sequences. So I'm not fixing the number. The length of the sequence doesn't play any role in what I do. Mm-hmm. So I just solve the combinatorial problem from the beginning. I get some numbers that tell me the answer to the question that I was posing at the beginning. How many sequences of half integers are that satisfy this condition and this condition? There is no restriction on the length, okay? So the point of view is different. In a sense, it's more basic. I'm just solving the combinatorial problem. I am not doing anything else. So then, of course, you can pose the problem in a different way, right? You can say, well, okay, I will count the number of sequences of a fixed length. Then it's another combinatorial problem. And then, of course, you can solve the problem for, you can look at the problem for different numbers and then combine the solutions to, for example, build what we have here.
Is it very different?
I don't think so. I actually have not thought about that because we really were worried about these specific problems. But it shouldn't be very different. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's doable. I'm sure it's doable basically with the same methods. There are people looking at that. Alejandro is basically doing that. Also, Senalovas and some collaborator is also looking at that point of view. And you can do the computations. They have several papers you can. It's quite straightforward. But here we don't introduce that label at all. As you can see, I mean, if you look at the details on how we get these generating functions, the number of punctures doesn't play any role at all. Okay?
You guys have questions? If you don't, thank you.